Yesterday I was continuing to talk about properties of linearized gravitational waves and zooming in on a specific property they have, namely what's classically called helicity, or also in the quantum theory, and that just meant that the circularly polarized waves behaved under rotations around the propagation axis by an angle theta, according to e to the I h theta, where we identified that for the gravitational waves, this was given by plus minus 2. And a similar thing we saw coming out of a kind of kinematical treatment where these rotations now form part of the Lorentz transformations, which are, or the Poincaré transformations more generally, which are unitarily implemented on states of any quantum field theory. And there, a very similar looking phase factor appeared, where here, well, I just called it something else. I called it sigma. But in sigma, modulus of sigma, we identified with the spin of the particle. OK, so this part, yesterday, that was a kind of purely kinematical discussion where I also mentioned some things about the representation theory of the Poincaré algebra that is somehow in the background of this entire analysis. And well, from questions that I was asked after the lecture, I realized that when I say, well, this is just, you know, standard QFT, but so that it may be not at everyone's fingertips quite yet. So what I want to start out doing today, quite briefly, just give you a little bit of background on the configuration space in the quantum theory on which this happens. And this is just Fock space. OK, so let me just give you a lightning review of how one gets to this in the quantum theory. So by this, I mean given kind of this bunch of plane wave solutions, complete set of solutions we found in the classical theory, well, how do I build a quantum theory, a quantum field theory from that in a, well, what is now a kind of a time-honored and standard manner? Well, let me go a little bit back to Adam and Eve by starting. This will be quick. So it's everything is stuff you know. But I just want you to take the slightly larger perspective of how it logically all hangs together. So let us just look at a simplest example, one of the simplest systems there is, the beloved harmonic oscillator in one dimensions. And for simplicity, let me take it to have unit mass, m equal to 1. I'm describing it by a pair of conjugate variables, x position and momentum p. And my Hamiltonian is quadratic in these variables, p squared half plus omega squared x squared half. Now, classically, I have my canonical Poisson brackets. So that's a kind of an algebraic structure that exists on the classical phase space of this theory and is captured by these kind of fundamental Poisson bracket relations. And I hope you've seen those somewhere. We get back to saying more about classical canonical structures next week. Now, you can think of quantization as representing these classical algebraic relations at the level of the self-adjoint quantization of these operators. And so these turn, these Poisson bracket relations in the quantum theory are turned into canonical commutation relations, where, well, first of all, you pick up a factor of I, And now, of course, there's a characteristic quantum H bar appears on the right hand side of those. Now, by taking, and this is all also, I think, what stuff you've seen in the quantum theory lectures before Christmas, by taking simple complex linear combinations of these x's and p's, you get to these variables a and a dagger, which have, I won't write the linear combinations explicitly, it's familiar stuff in principle, you get to a pair of variables, well, that satisfy slightly different relations. They commute to h bar. Now, and you can then rewrite, you can write what your Hamiltonian or your uniquely quantized Hamiltonian is in terms of these two new operators. It's given by h bar, so it comes in units of h bar omega, a dagger a plus 1/2. So quantum mechanically at this stage, I mean, this A and A dagger, well, they're not even self-adjoint. They don't have any specific direct interpretation. Yeah, so this, I have this harmonic oscillator system. Now, the eigenstates of this Hamiltonian are labeled by a positive integer, N, capital N. You can write it like this. So the spectrum of h hat is uniquely is essentially proportional to n, where n runs 0 to 1 to etc. So you see, well, one thing one sees here, so first of all, that is a ground state, right, 0, which is the lowest energy state of the system, which nevertheless has a non-vanishing positive energy, so the so-called, well, zero-point energy. And of course, that persists in quantum field theory. Now, another relation, let me just write a little more thing. In this corner, before I move to the other blackboard, this A operator applied on this ground state gives 0. That's also a kind of characteristic feature of this representation. Now, the remarkable thing, or the notable thing about this extremely simple spectrum, is that it is equidistantly spaced. Right, so you just, well, forget about this zero-point contribution. It's just proportional to n. So when I move up from one state, excited state, to the next higher state, things just differ by h bar omega. Now, because of this equidistant property of the spectrum, I can interpret this differently. And that will be kind of the relevant interpretation at the level of the quantum theory. I can interpret it as n. I can interpret this state as a state of n indistinguishable particles that each contribute, have an energy, h bar omega. That's, of course, not the original interpretation that came with this one-dimensional system. Yes. So that's kind of a simple but crucial thing to note. So this n. So it suggests to interpret this as a state of n particles, each with energy h bar omega. Now, you see, and at this stage, it's straightforward to make the jump to a field theory. So let's, for specificity and simplicity, just look at a massive scalar field, right? So So let's look at the theory of a free massive scalar field on Minkowski space. Well, this will satisfy equations of motion, and they are the Klein-Gordon equations. Box minus m squared phi of x equal to 0. But of course, you know of a, so this here is, of course, because of my conventions, signature conventions, minus del t squared plus nabla squared. Of course, you know straightforwardly how to solve this, namely by Fourier transformations, by Fourier transforming. And then each, it's straightforward to see then that each of the Fourier modes, they are now parameterized by a three vector k, the wave vector, satisfies a harmonic oscillator equation. So, like over here. Okay, so, but it happens for each k vector separately. So you get really, you can think of the system as a giving you kind of harmonic oscillators. And their energies proportional to omega or h bar omega, where omega is now omega with a label k, given by square root of m squared plus vector k squared. So for each of these scalar field modes. So now quantization is just applying kind of this quantization recipe to each one of these modes, right? And I can do this. It's just free waves. I can also, you know, superpose these solutions. So that is it's really completely straightforward. So therefore, you introduce now for each of these k modes a pair of a hat and a dagger hat, and well, already because of this particle interpretation you could adopt here. The A plays the role of an annihilation operator, and the A dagger that of a creation operator. So you get these pairs for every K, creation, annihilation operators, A dagger K, respectively A of K, and they satisfy canonical commutation relations. Where for two different wave vectors kk prime, you only get a non-vanishing contribution when these two things are equal. So these are your canonical commutation relations. Now, zero, so the kind of the no particle state, we then call the vacuum state. And of course, now you can systematically, by operating with your creation operators on this vacuum, you can generate states with any number of particles, where the individual particles then can have any momentum labels. Yeah, So a dagger applied on the vacuum, I could just label it, say, like this, state k. Now, this lives in the Hilbert space, and this is the Hilbert space of one particle states that already appeared yesterday in the discussion. So this is the of one particle states. But no one stops me sorry, I should add a k here. Well, let me create a two-particle state for you. That's straightforward. So I just apply this twice, and then I could, say, choose a notation like this. And this would now live in the tensor product of two of these H's. And, well, let me invent this notation just for the double, kind of the tensor product of two copies of this. And of course, arbitrary, I can now take, apply this arbitrarily many times, these creation operators, and kind of generally speaking, the Hilbert space, the configuration space of my field theory, which I call curly F, is given by the direct sum from n to infinity of all these tensor products, n-fold tensor products, in this manner. And this is called Fock space. Now, of course, I could, now we are talking here about bosons, about indistinguishable particles. So what one would usually do for that scalar field case, one would then go to the subspace of totally symmetrized functions. OK, let me not bother about these finer details here. But I mean, you see kind of the picture. So this Fock space is, that's kind of the habitat for the standard perturbative Minkowski space-based quantum field theories. And what is very nice about the setup is that any operator I can show can be obtained by a sum of products of annihilation and creation operators. So that's a kind of very universal framework. And kind of there's a couple of relations yesterday I had on the blackboard. We're just doing the same for the gravitons, right? And the only thing that happened was that I had an additional kind of spin helicity degree of freedom here, an additional label, but and then an additional delta function. But otherwise, this was exactly what you could do for the gravitons. Okay. Now we are ready to face the path integral. Hopefully. Again, what I'll start with is a recap of things you have already seen. I don't know to what extent you've actively worked with them, but truly there were some in the exercises of both, I think there's your quantum theory course and the, certainly the QFT2 course, that were dealing with path integrals initially at the level of quantum mechanics. Now, what I want to do is just, again, give you a brief reminder of the two ways, equivalent ways, of doing quantum mechanics, the canonical way involving operators, solving the Schrödinger equation, and the covariant way by essentially making a path integral construction of what one calls the propagator of the theorem, which however, is at least in cases where we can do this, is entirely equivalent. Right. So let me just remind you how this goes. Before moving on to the how this goes in quantum mechanics, before moving on to the much more complicated case of gravity. okay, things get insignificantly more difficult from here. So let us look at the quantum mechanics of a non-relativistic particle. So understood that this happens in three dimensions. Now again, I can start from the classical phase space of the system. Where I now have three pairs, xi and pi, I running from 1 to 3, with xi pj Poisson brackets giving a delta ij. Now, let me choose simple, standard simple Hamiltonian, consisting of standard kinetic term, x vector dot squared plus some potential term that depends only on the coordinates. And well, in the following is kind of assumed sufficiently nice and simple so that these things actually go through. Now, so again, we quantize, we put hats on everything. That gives us operators xi hat, pi hat, and h. And what is the Hilbert space these things live on? The space of square integrable functions on R3. So that's kind of the initial configuration space you started out with respect to the measure dx. And well, you have the canonical commutation relations. I proportional to I h bar. Now you have a delta ij. So this is just, again, follows kind of from the requirement to keep an algebraic relation that existed at the classical level, to keep that at the quantum level. And this is, as one can show, if one asks for a unitary or here an implementation in terms of self-adjoint operators, to make the statement more precise, one should actually go to the exponentiated version of these, which will then be unitary operators. But nevertheless, essentially, if both of these are supposed to have a spectrum that's the entire real line, then more or less that fixes uniquely the representation to the standard one you're used to, the kind of the Schrödinger representation. So where xi hat is represented by multiplication by xi, and pi hat is minus I h bar d by d xi. When I say unique, I mean, of course, unique up to unitary equivalence, right? And you know, for example, that you can go to a momentum space representation, but these are all unitarily equivalent. Now, your quantum Hamiltonian is then uniquely quantized using these operators, minus h bar squared divided by 2m plus Laplacian plus v, and well, in your potential, wherever you had a dependence on x, you now put a dependence on x. Now you put a dependence on your quantized x. And again, this better be kind of sufficiently nice. And What you then have to do in order to solve that quantum mechanical system, now this is time independent, so what you have to solve is just the eigenvalue equation. So we must solve the eigenvalue equation h hat psi of x equal to e psi of x. Right, then I know the spectrum of the Hamiltonian, and that's what one means by, and the eigenstates, and that's what one means by solving the theory. Now, entirely equivalently, you can do something else to get to the solution of the quantum dynamics. You start by defining a unitary time evolution operator that knows about this Hamiltonian H here. So define unitary time evolution operator so it evolves you from time t0 to time t, and it's just the unitary transformation with generator, the Hamiltonian. So this is h times this time interval, all divided by h bar. And I trust you have seen this type of relation before. So this you can now use to describe the time evolution of your states psi at a given time t. You can express it as what you get from applying this unitary operator at time t naught. Okay, to bring this into slightly familiar, more familiar, explicit form, one usually goes to a specific basis. So let us choose the position eigenbasis eigenstates labeled by x vector. So with a defining relation that they act diagonally on these, the x's act diagonally on these states by multiplication. And of course, keeping in mind that these give an improper basis of your Hilbert space, right, L2 of R3 in the usual manner. This is standard quantum mechanics. Now, let me define a wave function psi of x and t in this bracket notation as eigenstate vector x ket my wave function, time-dependent wave function. And let me now look at this equation here. Now what I do, I just take a scalar product here on both the left and the right hand side with the state, eigenstate x. So what I get on the right hand side here, let me see what I'm doing. Yeah, this x prime actually. So what I'm getting on the right hand, left hand side is a psi of x prime t. So that came from taking the scalar product with the state x prime. Now, if I do the same on the right hand side, let me first of all copy what was written there. Psi t naught. And now let me insert a resolution of the identity just in here. So let me insert a complete set of eigenstates, x. And because this is a continuous label, I pick up an integration, an x integration, this manner. So let me choose, let me call this inserted variable x double prime. And here is now my insertion, complete kind of insertion resolution of the identity. I get twice this, get a cat and a bra here, and the original psi of t naught. So I hope it's clear that this relation follows from the one up there. Now, this by definition, I call psi of x double prime and t zero. And now this thing, sorry, the whole thing, usually gets also a special notation, capital G, where you keep track of both the x arguments and the time arguments, like this, x prime t semicolon x double prime t zero. And you see now your time evolution equation has become kind of an involution. So this G is therefore also called a kernel. It's sometimes called the Feynman kernel or the propagator of the theory. So the propagator, it kind of contains, well, it consists of these matrix elements in the position basis and that kind, but it basically, it describes evolution from a point x double prime at time, initial time t zero, to a final position x prime and time t. So this is called the set Feynman kernel or propagator . And the information contained in this is, of course, equivalent to the information contained in H hat, I mean, the quantum Hamiltonian. Now, the interesting thing is that we have a way to get to this propagator in a constructive manner, if you like, from a path integral construction, right? So let me just remind you how this goes. Firstly, of course, we are now looking, we're looking at a very simple example where the Hamiltonian wasn't explicitly time dependent. So this actually only depends on the time difference of these two, t and t naught. So what I might write here is kind of a g. In which order did I write things? So I can write x prime, x, and t, well, this t is just simply the difference now between t and t zero. So by, I'm just copying what's written on this other blackboard. This is x prime. Now I'm putting in the explicit form for the unitary time evolution as the exponentiated Hamiltonian. T time t divided by h bar scalar product x. Now, and this here, as you've already learned, can be obtained from a path integral. So where we are specifying, this is a formal integral over paths. I say more about this in a second, where we are fixing the initial and the final points of the path at time 0 and t to be x and x primed. So these are exactly the arguments that fit here. And where you are integrating over e to the I h bar s of x and t. Yep.
The propagator is supposed to be the Green's function of something, like of the Schrodinger equation or something.
Yeah, yes.
So I mean, this is not the normal way to use a Green's function, right? This integral.
It's not the normal way. Well, it's just the way it appears here. That different things you call the propagator. Now, well, I'm just saying different names are being used to this. This is kind of an involution kernel, clearly, here at this stage.
So it's not the Green's function of anything?
Well, it's a Green's function of something, yeah. Well, it's basically, it is the Green's function of the Schrodinger operator.
Oh, the Schrodinger operator.
Yeah. So, well, you can think of it as depending just on one of the arguments, and then you'll see it will just directly solve the Schrodinger equation. So now what is this S of X here? S now this is a functional dependence, so it depends on an entire path which is encoded in kind of this the fact that this is an integral here, and what you're integrating over is m half x vector dot squared minus b of x. So this is a classical action for the path x of t. So this doesn't depend on a point x at some time, but it depends on an entire path where now t, of course, runs from, well, so I'm choosing a slightly ambiguous notation. It runs from 0 to t, so I should call that t prime. Okay, here I've called it t prime as an integration parameter. So that's kind of the path integral prescription. And how do you get to this? How do you get to this in your quantum theory course? You get to it through a limiting process where you discretize this integral over all paths, which a priori anyway, you don't exactly know what is. So you discretize that, kind of following the procedure by Feynman. And so you're getting it from a limiting process. Let me make the picture first. So you're starting out from some point x of 0, which I called again x, at time t, you're supposed to have arrived at the point x prime. So that's what this dot here indicates. You will slice up. So this is the time direction in this picture. So you slice up this thing into delta t is the total time duration divided over n equal steps. And what you're doing, effectively in the path integral, you are now summing over all piecewise straight paths that take you from your initial to your final point. So this entire time duration is t. The step is delta t. So this here would be the point x at time delta t. Here are the points have coordinate x of time 2 delta t, etc. So the limiting process now, of course, consists, I mean, in doing this, so for fixed finite n, you can just do this computation. You discretize your original Hamiltonian here, the pieces that appeared here. And then you take a limit. What's what we're writing? A limiting process where you let the individual delta t's go to 0 while simultaneously letting the number of steps go to infinity. And as I said, for each finite t, you just do this integration over a subset of paths that are these simple piecewise straight paths. Paths that are made of n segments. So, and that's indeed something you've seen explicitly done. So if one does it this way, one gets explicit expressions for this path integral measure here as a specific limit as n goes to infinity that comes out of this kind of regularization, this discretization. And you also, this is also the way you get to this S of x of t. So you discretize, you make the differentials, sorry, the velocities that appear in the Hamiltonian, you make them into finite differences. And well, after a number of kind of non-trivial algebraic steps, one also has to worry about, you know, convergences or making the right substitutions, etc., you arrive at explicit expressions, again, for sufficiently simple potentials V, for this path integral. So you now we have a path integral prescription of how, in principle, to compute this object, what I call the propagator, and therefore solve the dynamics of the quantum theory. So there are a few things I wanted to draw your attention to in this construction, because they are certainly they're relevant for any generalizations as we want to make, namely a vast generalization for the case of gravity. OK, so first of all, note, of course, we started from kind of the Hamiltonian, well, the quantum Hamiltonian, and we ended up with an action. So what had kind of happened, and that's, of course, if you look back at the details of the construction, kind of a relative sign swap has taken place between the kinetic and the potential terms, if you like. So this is just how it comes about, because of how you represented kind of the free Hamiltonian, so just the kinetic part. This, of course, is now, as I emphasized, a functional integral. So it's an integral over functions. And what are the functions? The functions are the path from 0 that that map you from the interval 0 t, so your time interval, to R3 with suitable boundary conditions, which you're holding fixed there. OK, so it's certainly a non-trivial object mathematically. Now, what you also see, if you now really wanted to do this integration, you are likely to run into trouble. Why? Well, this is not even a kind of a good measure, because if you also if you look at the explicit representation of this, it's complex, and this entire integrand is of course complex. So it's difficult. It's not. I'm not saying it's impossible. It's difficult to discuss the limiting this limiting process in a mathematically clean way, as long as you're working with these complex amplitudes. And also note, of course, h bar is very small, so this is also generally very strongly oscillating. So you'll have troubles making sense individually out of these various pieces of what you see under the path integral in this complex for these complex phase factors. Now, what is a very nice way of making this mathematically well defined is to analytically continue. Let me just write this here. Maybe 5 minutes. So to analytically continue the time variable. Continue to imaginary time, namely. And that's usually called tau, simply I times your original time t. So that leads to something that's a so-called a Euclidean path integral, where these complex phase factors are turned into real objects. And the entire integral then becomes real. And you can actually, it's mathematically well-defined, that's something you can do. You can now discuss properly the convergence properties of this path integral, which you get, which you're getting through this limiting process. Now, the construction, so that can actually be done explicitly. It's a nice piece of functional analysis, and it involves now in this Euclideanized framework, it involves the so-called the Wiener measure. Right. So the Wiener measure is a particular measure you are constructing in this way, and it's a well-known, of course, object to mathematicians. And what for us is interesting, and I want to draw your attention to, is now what is this Wiener measure? So if I now have taken kind of the continuum limit, here delta t goes to 0. Again, you can think of that as a short distance cutoff, of course. Then can I say anything about where this measure is concentrated? And it turns out, I mean, this mathematical construction makes a definite statement about this. It says, well, with probability 1, so almost always, kind of a path you pick from kind of the this quantum ensemble, if you like, is a nowhere differentiable path. So that's a path that is just full of corners, right? It's nowhere differentiable. It's nowhere smooth at all. So it's an entirely non-classical thing. Yes. So let me just make a note of that. In the continuum limit, let me phrase it this way. So the path integral is dominated by nowhere differentiable paths. And if you want to read up on this construction explicitly and find the proper technical statement, you could go to the books by Reed and Simon. I think it's the second volume. Now, why is that physically, is there something wrong with this? No, there isn't. Because the paths that enter into the path integral, they're not classical paths, right? So they're what one calls virtual paths. So in no way, when you made this construction, for example, did you require that these paths solved the classical equations of motion, or even approximately solved the classical equation of motion. No, and they don't. So nevertheless, kind of they give you the kind of the space of all possibilities, and you're superposing all of this, and the magic of the quantum theory and the magic of the path integral is that they return the correct quantum result to you. And of course, after the dust test settlement has computed this, this is entirely, of course, equivalent to having diagonalized the quantum Hamiltonian. Right? So so keep this in mind. Now today I'm not getting to the gravitational case, but we'll do that starting tomorrow. But keep this in mind. What we'll do for gravity, of course, I'll present you first with the analogous setup, and then we'll see what we can do about it perturbatively and later on non-perturbatively. Thank you.